DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, hunters in Spain revive an ancient form of pig killing.
The adrenaline, the emotion is beautiful. You're not stalking behind an animal.
Rebel groups in Africa sell ivory to China and use the money to buy weapons.
They took these 300 animals, killed them by AK-47, took the ivory, left the carcasses.
We visit the first Global Youth Sustainability Summit.
Doesn't matter how young you are, but if we continue pressing on them, it will be hard for them not to reply to us.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. We start this week in rural Spain, where an ancient hunting ritual is making a comeback. For animal lovers, the name alone is enough to make tempers flare. It's called pig sticking. It involves hunting wild boars on horseback with spears. The sport goes back to ancient times and is now controlled under Spanish hunting regulations. Lauren Freyer rode along with these horseback hunters and sends us this report.
Horses trot softly across sandy terrain and scrubby oak brush here on Spain's central plateau. Their riders are listening for a rustle in the leaves, searching for a patch of wiry black fur. Finally, the hunters spot their prey. They yank their reins in unison, aim their spears, and steer their horses up steep terrain laced with tree roots and boulders. Ducking low-slung branches, they race ahead in pursuit of a giant wild boar.
For thousands of years, the only way to get a boar was to chase it with a horse. There was no other weapon.
Ramiro Maura owns this ranch near Madrid, where he's helping to revive the ancient Roman practice of pig sticking, hunting wild boar on horseback with spears, not guns. While firearms are legal in Spain, Maura says hunting with a spear brings him closer to nature and his ancestors' rural traditions.
How sportive and how challenging and how difficult it is to gallop through tough terrains after a wild animal and eventually managing to get it.
It sometimes takes all day for expert riders to finally corner a single wild boar and then stab the animal with long spears. This boar uses his tusks to try to attack one of the horses and then cries out as a spear pierces his heart, killing him instantly. The animal is then hauled away to be cooked for dinner, but others are often exported to Germany, the number one destination for wild boar meat from Spain. Pig sticking went virtually unnoticed by animal rights groups here until last summer, when the regional government of Castilla-La Mancha, south of the Spanish capital, added the sport to updated hunting regulations. Rules now govern how many riders may be armed, four, and prohibit hunting during the boar's mating season. But despite a growing animal rights movement in Spain and the recent ban on bullfighting in Catalonia, there's been little uproar over pig sticking, says Sharon Nunez, a spokeswoman for the group Animal Equality.
It's something that hasn't got a lot of publicity, and it's something I think most Spanish citizens are not aware of. If they were, I am sure that a great percentage of them would be against this kind of cruel sport.
Nunez opposes recent efforts by the cash-strapped Spanish government to privatize public land, converting more public parks to private hunting reserves. She says that while every effort should be made to uphold rural traditions like hunting, there's a limit.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same case with bullfighting. I mean, a tradition shouldn't stay or shouldn't remain if it's cruel and it means suffering and death to an innocent creature.
But where some find cruelty, others see beauty. Our hunting group includes a Spanish poet and a painter from England.
The adrenaline, the emotion is beautiful. You're not stalking behind an animal.
Claro, it's very poetic. The animal is running to live one more day.
Pig sticking is like Dutch heaven.
Pig sticking has been around since Roman times, and perhaps even before that. Prehistoric cave paintings in northern Spain depict primitive man on horseback chasing wild boar with spears. The sport was also popular in colonial India. The 19th century founder of the Boy Scouts movement, Robert Baden Powell, wrote a seminal book on pig sticking. The sport's resurgence now is part of a push by rural Spaniards to keep their traditions alive, as millions abandon the Spanish countryside for jobs in cities. Wildfires ravage abandoned land each summer, and now less than 20% of Spaniards live in rural areas.
To me, the thing that makes me more sad, and it's my biggest battle.
Jaime Patiño wears his grandfather's leather chaps and boots and a 19th century style suit jacket to go riding. He's watched his home village empty out of residents. And he sees pig sticking as part of a movement towards sustainable land use, maintaining terrain that might otherwise be abandoned and left vulnerable to wildfires.
We are the people that really protect the nature, and we are passionate of the countryside. And after that, you know, we are hunters and all that. But first of all, we are country people.
Patiño lives in the city now, but takes his children hunting often. He wants them to understand the rural traditions of their ancestors.
You cannot understand how the nature works if you don't see what's going on. It's very important that children know how does the eagle eats the mouse and the fox eats the eagle, and it goes on. And it's nature and it's life.
To that end, Patiño and Mora, the ranch owner, have founded the Pig Sticking Club of Spain, through which they host guest hunters from around the world. They even have a Facebook page with 6,000 supporters and counting. Lauren Freyer, DW, Madrid.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned the Security Council about the slaughter of endangered elephants, rhinos, tigers, and other species. He argued that the poaching and trafficking of these animals is a threat to national and regional security. I'm joined now by Volker Homes. He's the head of species conservation at the Worldwide Fund for Nature, also known as the WWF. Mr. Homes, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First, for those who are unfamiliar with wildlife trafficking, could you explain what this is?
So this means huge animals like elephants and rhinos and even tigers are killed for their parts. So from elephant, the ivory is taken, or from rhino, the horn, and then sold for thousands of US dollar or euro. And with this money, basically, other crime is financed. This is of particular concern.
Maneka Gandhi, an Indian animal rights activist, recently wrote that animal trafficking has exceeded arms and drug trafficking. And she also said that there are well-organized criminal syndicates shifting into the lucrative animal trade. What can you tell me about that?
So this is of particular concern. This is quite recent. So with regard to rhinos, about a decade ago, 10 years ago, only about one dozen, so 12 rhinos have been poached per year. But the number increased dramatically by thousands of percent, 700 rhinos being poached each year. And this is not sustainable. So the species is highly threatened. And if that continues, the increase continues, we are looking for local extinction of the species.
Now, what you're talking about is an environmental issue, but it's also a regional security issue. Ban Ki-moon was making this point that the Security Council needs to get engaged, that local governments need to get engaged. What I'm interested in finding out is how the money that comes from wildlife trafficking is used to purchase weapons and support violent conflict.
So what we are facing at this point in time is that in regions like Central Africa, there are some states that have problems with poaching. So foreigners are coming in mainly from the Sahel belt, so the dry areas of the sub-Sahara, going into Chad, into Cameroon and Central African Republic, and basically taking the elephants, killing the elephants, taking the ivory, selling the ivory, and then buying weapons and other illegal stuff with these funds. And this is well beyond the environmental sector and beyond an NGO like WWF. So it reached actually the UN Security Council. And I think this tells a story in itself.
Now, I read that actually even groups like the Lord's Resistance Army is involved. Have you heard that as well?
Yeah, in the report of Ban Ki-moon, he is explaining that the Lord's Resistance Army that is operating in central and eastern parts of Africa and Democratic Republic of Congo, that these groups are using the money that is coming from elephant ivory as well.
So this marks a major shift in thinking on wildlife trafficking. We're not just talking, as you said, about an environmental issue alone, but a challenge, a global challenge to peace and security. And that seems to imply a need for a broad strategy, so involving many different government and non-government partners. What, in your opinion, needs to be done? What is the next best step?
The people on the ground are facing these criminal groups. They have fear. People are losing their lives. For example, the rangers and the wildlife guards, they are facing death, basically.
Do you mean that rebel groups and criminal groups are actually going into these areas and not only killing the animals, but also killing the rangers who have been tasked with protecting them?
This is documented, and it's a tragedy. This was happening mainly in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and we're facing similar things at the moment in Cameroon, where a new government is ruling the country, but obviously the security situation is not stable at all, and a lot of people are dying as well because they try to protect wild animals.
I'd like to look at the case of ivory and follow the supply chain with you. Let's start out in nature. How is ivory sourced?
Elephants are carrying the most ivory. Ivory comes as well from other animals like walruses, but elephant ivory is the main source.
Can you take me into the forest and tell me what the hunt looks like?
So what we are facing at the moment is a highly cruel process. So in northern Cameroon, about 1 year ago, about 50 people came in on horseback. They were highly weaponed, and they took more than 300 elephants at the same strike. So in 1 to 2 months, they took these 300 animals, killed them by AK-47, so machine guns basically, took the ivory, left the carcasses in the field, and just were going for the ivory. And another strike happened in Chad about 1 year later, so only months back in time, so early 2013, about 86 elephants were taken and killed by machine guns, and many of the elephants were pregnant, actually.
Okay, now if we move forward in the supply chain, where does that ivory go once these rebel groups have it in their hands?
So it's not easy to track, of course, because all is illegal. It's illegal to kill the elephants. It's illegal to take the ivory and then sell it. However, this is happening. And we basically know that ivory is sold via different middlemen and then mainly going to the east of the continent. So mainly to Kenya, to Tanzania, and to Mozambique. And from there, it's mainly shipped. So ships are used to ship it to East and Southeast Asia. There are various stations in this shipping lanes. The Philippines play a role, Vietnam play a role as middlemen, and most of the ivory is ending up in China then.
I'm curious what it is that you would like to see as concrete action. What is the next best step?
We have to make sure that there's implementation on the ground. So we need more rangers. We even need more military to protect World Heritage sites, to protect the sites where the elephants still are. Otherwise, we're facing at least regional extinction of these species.
Volker Holmes is the head of species conservation with the Worldwide Fund for Nature, also known as the WWF. Mr. Holmes, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. They don't eat, don't sleep. Guns are when they moan and squeak, lick the dirt off a larger one's feet. They don't push, don't crowd, congregate until they're much too loud. Look to procreate till they are dead. Drink the blood of this accomplished prayer. Hey, don't scurry with something bigger comes away. Don't pack themselves together and
We cover some pretty tough topics here on Living Planet, so I think it's time for a reminder that there are lots of optimistic, engaged people out there trying to do their bit to protect the environment. We're going to meet some young environmentalists who traveled from all over the world for the first ever Global Youth Sustainability Summit. It was held right here in Germany. They were a rather energetic bunch ready to tackle the environmental challenges of the 21st century. Our reporter Naomi Conrad was there. She brings us this report.
Outside Berlin's Brandenburg Gate, the tourist touts out in full force. A Darth Vader impersonator is edging towards a group of North American tourists, skillfully dodging less well-heeled tourists unlikely to fork out a handful of euros for a picture. A couple of meters to the left, a long-haired hippie is hammering away on his keyboard. Despite the hordes of tourists milling around, his expression is glum. A large group of teenagers in matching green and white t-shirts is jimmying and jumping around to a pop song. Their raucous singing is slightly off-key, but it's free. All thereafter is attention, Drin Krasniqi explains. He's in Berlin for the first Youth Sustainability Summit hosted by the international NGO You Think Green.
There are 160 youngsters from more than 30 countries, and we are basically working and try to find a solution about how the future is going to look and try to find a solution for a more sustainable future.
Drin smiles. The 17-year-old from Kosovo is weighed down by a huge, bulky brown backpack, stuffed full of balloons and plastic bottles, meant to symbolize the Earth's pollution. But he's still able to sprint up to an elderly couple who are eyeing him curiously and push a fly on the youth summit into their hand. Soon, they're chatting away. Petalina France is impressed. That would never happen back home, she says.
Our country is still developing and they're still in their own mentality. They don't really listen to children.
The petite 16-year-old is from Namibia.
But I think if you actually know what you're saying and know what you're doing, then I think you can get a number of people to listen. It doesn't matter how young you are. But, I mean, if we continue pressing on them, it will be hard for them not to reply to us or respond to what we're saying, and, you know.
Petalina and a couple of her friends from her boarding school have been petitioning local politicians to install solar panels. They've also launched a scheme to get people in Windhoek to switch from public transport to bikes. In her school, she's gained a bit of a reputation, she says, pushing back her long plaited hair.
We'd be brushing our teeth in the morning and everyone's water is running. I'm like, guys, turn off the water. And like, you know, everyone goes downstairs to go to school. And then I'm like turning off all the lights. It's kind of, I put up posters for everyone to see. It's kind of just something I've become, you know. And it's kind of funny because everyone looks at me like, she's a little crazy.
She shrugs, then grins. She doesn't care. From a young age, her mother taught her to switch off lights and save energy. Then an environmental awareness class at school on the shrinking ozone layer gave her the idea to go out and do something. Like the other teenagers in Berlin, she's hoping to do her bit to save the world. She wants to become Namibia's first environmental lawyer and force politicians to act.
Namibia has so much potential, and I think if they're not careful, the other countries will take advantage of their resources and everything. I just want them to make the right decisions that won't have an after effect on them.
With enough determination, she may manage to do just that, Jakob von Uexküll says. He's the founder of the Right Livelihood Award, often referred to as the alternative Nobel Prize for environmental activism.
Governments are still afraid of those who prepare to go out. If you have a long-term blockade of a coal-fired power station, for example, that's the way to close it down.
Uexküll is one of the speakers who have been coaching the young delegates on how to take action, access funds and make their voices heard.
Al Gore said he's surprised that there aren't more young people out there blockading coal-fired power stations, and I'm also surprised.
That, the delegates agree, is down to apathy among many young people and a short-term, self-centered view of the world many of their peers take.
And I think what we should do is just really get everyone to know and see what we see, because I think a lot of people would really, like, you know, understand and, you know, try to get a better future for everyone, yeah.
But will Petalina continue to persuade her friends to give up meat and ride bicycles? Once she has a full-time job, a family even. The 16-year-old smiles. She wants to set an example to her children and their children. As she heads back to the other activists still singing and stomping to the music, Petalina suddenly bends down to pick up a paper napkin lazily flapping in the breeze. She stuffs it into the nearest dustbin, then jogs off to join the others. Not far away, Drin has cornered another couple. Darth Vader, meanwhile, is posing for a photo with two tourists in matching miniskirts. For DW, this is Naomi Conrad in Berlin.
Next up on Living Planet, we've got a new story about African resources prepared by our sister show Africa Link. They've been looking at who owns resources like oil and precious metals. And this week, they're taking us to Tanzania, a country sitting on a $1 billion gold mine. The problem is that locals don't see much of the profit. The mines are firmly under the control of international companies. Well, that's triggered violent clashes in the North Mara region on the border with Kenya. Yulia Hahn has this report for us. The English version has been read by Jesse Wingard.
Here in Kiwanja, less than 30 minutes from the Kenyan border, Jumane clambers up a huge hill of debris. He takes a sip of water from his plastic bottle and spits on the stone he's just picked up. He rubs it with his thumb and beams as he sees the colour gold shine through. Quickly, he stuffs it into his pocket.
We work here. The mountain belongs to us. But the white people, they make it hard. They have us arrested. The police chase us away. It's really tough. There are only problems here.
Jumane is a so-called intruder. The hill of debris belongs to the company African Barrick Gold, a subsidiary of the world's biggest gold producer, Barrick Gold, in Canada. The stones are a waste product from the nearby mine. For many of Kiwanja's inhabitants, they represent the only chance to make some money. Several times a day, groups of intruders rush up the hill hoping to grab some gold. Jumane sells the gold he's found at the village market for around 200,000 Tanzanian shillings a month. That makes him one of the region's biggest earners. Other intruders sell the stones to middlemen who process them into gold dust and nuggets. The company keeps a close watch on the area, aided by local police. They're armed with tear gas, rubber bullets, and live ammunition. In 2012, at least 8 people were reported to have been shot dead.
Barrick doesn't care about the surrounding people. Yeah, it doesn't care. That's why we are being shot like dogs. Yeah, the police do what the Barrick tells them. Marionette.
The really big money is made on the other side of the debris mountain, in the mine itself, where the rocks are blasted from the ground by controlled explosions. In 2011, ABG's turnover was more than 200 million euros. The company says it's taken on 360 local employees and another 1,500 work as service providers. That's not much out of a regional population of 70,000 people. Of course, the company has a social responsibility, says mine manager Gary Chapman.
We will, with time and consistency and developing trust with ourselves and the community, we will be able to get at least respect from the community. We would like to, I don't think we'd actually like to be loved, but certainly a mutual respect and working together and developing things would be the ideal way to go.
ABG have created a special department for community relations in North Mara. A team of 17 men and women travel through the region, establishing contact with village elders and community leaders. They also visit existing social projects, such as Ingweave Secondary School, just a short drive from the mine. The main school building was renovated in 2008 and is now being expanded. The work is being done by local firms. That creates jobs, says ABG. Joash Magika is the school's headmaster.
I feel all right. Yes, there was a great changes. The school is looking very nice now. the number of the students who went to as intruders now is decreasing, yeah, because of the nature of the school now. But they're still going. We try to educate them, to know what is the importance of education and how education can help them to solve their problem in the future.
Since 2010, ABG has paid out $20.6 million for social projects in the whole of Tanzania. That sounds like a lot, but is less than 1% of its total annual turnover. Source Peter Mohongo is the Government Minister for Energy and Minerals and himself comes from North Mara. He raised taxes for the mining companies and wants to see more social commitment, but he rejects claims that politicians should have done more in the past.
We have tried and we are not going to stop. We will continue pursuing all that we can to make sure that there is peace and security in that area. And one of the ways to solve this, first, we have to invest in education. I think if they are well-learned, they are educated, having much more education, they will be thinking otherwise.
So far, there's little sign of this in Kiwanja, not as long as people can make a living from gold obtained illegally. In a secret hideaway, the stones found by the intruders are turned into gold nuggets. Some are ground into a fine powder. A man, working with his bare hands, uses highly toxic mercury to bind the particles. He says he knows it's dangerous, but...
Everyone wants to have enough money to feed their family. I used to work as a farmer. In a year, I earned then what I earn now in a single day.
He holds up a gold nugget weighing about a gram. That will bring about 20 euros on the black market. A tiny fraction of Tanzania's raw materials wealth, acquired at the risk of being shot dead by police or poisoned.
Thank you to Yulia Hahn for that report. The English version was read by Jesse Wingard.
As sly as a fox, as strong as an ox, as fast as a hare, as brave as a bear.
And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. We'll be back again next week with a sizzling hot broadcast on solar energy. In the meantime, you can visit us at dw.de/environment or follow us on Twitter at dw_eco. For now, I'm Saroja Coelho. From all of us here in studio, thanks for listening.
As mean as a wolf, as sharp as a tooth, as deep as a bite, as dark as the night, as sweet as a song, as right as a wrong, as long as a road, as ugly as a toad, as pretty as a picture hanging from a fixture, strong like a family, strong as I wanna be, bright as day, as light as a plane, as hard as nails, as grand as a whale. Fun, as cool as a tree, as scary as the sea, as hot as fire, cold as ice, sweet as sugar and everything nice, as old as time, as straight as a line, as royal as a queen.